Good day to you. I'm Michael Ramey, and this is the EPIC Broadcast, the official podcast of the Parental Rights Foundation. EPIC, EPPC, stands for Empowering Parents, Protecting Children, which is the heartbeat of the Parental Rights Foundation. My guest today is Kathleen Creamer, the managing attorney of the Family Advocacy Unit at Community Legal Services in Philadelphia. She sits on the governing board of the United Family Advocates, a bipartisan coalition to preserve families and fix the child welfare system. She's a member of the Pennsylvania Child Welfare Council and a member of the steering committee for the American Bar Association's National Alliance for Parent Representation. As a result, it should come as no surprise that she was right in the middle of things at the ABA Center on Children and the Law's National Conference on Parent Representation, held April 11th and 12th here in Northern Virginia. And we're going to get an update on that event in this episode. Kathleen, welcome back to the EPIC Broadcast.
Thanks for having me. I think this might be my third time with you, right? I love working with you guys and always grateful for all the guests you bring on your podcast.
Yeah, no, I think it has been the third time. And yeah, I always enjoy having you on. It's always great talking to you. So let's dive in. Tell us about the National Conference on Parent Representation. First, when did this get started and how did it come about?
So this started in the early 2000s. The American Bar Association started really looking deeply at parent representation and child representation, but really thinking about what is good parent representation, how do you do it well, how do we build support for parent representation across the country? How do we define what high quality looks like? How do we get funding for high quality legal representation? And so that work was led by the ABA and is led by the ABA through the National Alliance for Parent Representation. And every 2 years since the mid 2000s, there's been a national conference. This conference was really exciting because we are really at a moment where so much of the hard work over the last couple of decades is starting to show fruit and take off. We had so many rooms that were standing room only. The conference itself was oversubscribed. We had to put folks on a waiting list to get into the conference. Not everybody could attend who wanted to attend, which is a little frustrating, but also kind of an amazing marker of how exciting the work is right now.
Well, so now I feel a little less bad that I didn't go. As we've had opportunity, I've told you before, I just assumed since I'm not a lawyer, yeah, I can't go to the ABA thing. And then I learned at the last minute that I could have. So I'm planning to go to the next one. But now I don't feel quite so bad that I missed it, because I probably would have just been on a waiting list anyway. So,
well, I do want to say we are trying to build a big tent movement around family defense for families who are impacted by the child welfare system. And so you're absolutely invited, Michael. And we had a really diverse audience this time. We did have family defense attorneys from all over the country, but we had peer advocates. We had other folks with lived experience in the child welfare system. We had social workers. We had policy advocates. We had journalists. So I would love to see you at the next one.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I also kind of felt like I wouldn't have wanted to take somebody else's spot, because I get to talk to all of you guys already anyway. I mean, I know so many names on the list who were there. So as much as I wanted to be there among you all, also, it's kind of good to let other people meet you guys and hear what you have to say. So so I guess it worked out for the best, but I definitely plan to be there for the next one. So what were some of the topics this year? Did you have any favorites?
You know, it was I was on the planning committee, so I definitely had a little bit of a say in who got to present and what kind of presentations we invited to the table. And I feel like it was one of the most exciting conferences we've ever put on. So many superstars at the conference.
Yeah.
One who really stood out to me was Roxana Azgarian. I don't know if you have read her book yet, We Were Once a Family.
No, I haven't.
Oh, I could not recommend that book more highly. We Were Once a Family is an incredible act of journalism. Roxana followed a family of children who had been adopted from the child welfare system and it was a very sensationalized story in the media. The adoptive mothers of these children actually drove them off a cliff
Oh,
and they
yes.
all died. But Roxanna took a really interesting lens to the work because the media was really focusing on the sensational story of these, adoptive parents who did something horrific. But Roxanna was like, wait a second, why were these kids in foster care? Why did their families get separated in the first place? Who are their families? And so really traces the history of these children's lives and their families in a really profoundly humane and thoughtful way that is unfortunately not characteristic of a lot of media reporting that you see out there in child welfare. And to me, it's just such a thoughtful book, but also such a galvanizing book. It makes you want to go out and change the child welfare system because you see over and over as she does her work, the way that the structures of the system really drive bad outcomes for kids and for their parents and families. So great book. Could not recommend it more to your readers. Some books I read and, in child welfare and I like them, but they feel a little like homework. We Were Once a Family is not homework. It is like an unputdownable book. I sat and read it in one afternoon. I literally couldn't put it down.
Wow.
Could not recommend it more. So getting to meet Roxanna as Gary and the reporter in person, I went to two of her sessions. It was incredible because she's really not only challenging the kind of conventional wisdom about how we think about families impacted by the child welfare system, she's also challenging the conventional wisdom about how the media reports about families impacted by the child welfare system. So I was so excited to have her in our space. Yeah.
Wow. Great. Awesome. Yeah, it's I'm see, I admire you and the space that you occupy and the things that you do, and you're involved in so many things. I mean, I shortened your bio a lot at the beginning of this episode. I know you're so busy, you do so much. And then I'm watching you kind of sort of fangirl over her. It's kind of cool. Like, wow, so okay. I will definitely be getting the book and checking it out.
Michael, I will say I have so many heroes in this field. Like there are so many people that I think are just doing incredible work. And like one really amazing thing about this field is that it's small enough that you get to meet your heroes. So also at the conference was
Ooh.
Dorothy Roberts, another one of my heroes in this field. Marty Guggenheim was there, another one of the greats of this field. And so it's really a cool space because it's a small enough field that, even the legends of the field are very accessible, and they happen to be amazing human beings who want to be accessible, right? And so
Right.
that's an incredible thing about going to these conferences.
Awesome. So, any other of the sessions that maybe our audience should know about?
Yes, I was really impressed by David Shalit Klein. I don't know if you've had him on your show yet. He's an
No.
incredible lawyer out of New York City. He founded the Family Justice Law Center, and his office just launched litigation in New York City about the impact of child welfare investigations on families and the way that agencies override parents' right to Fourth Amendment protections when child welfare agencies are coming into their homes.
Yeah.
And they just filed this landmark piece of litigation. It's still early days for the litigation itself. The complaint was just filed, but David did an incredible presentation where he went over line by line how they designed the complaint. And the complaint itself, I can fangirl out all day over great lawyering. But also, I would say, even to your readers who aren't lawyers, if you could read that complaint, like you would be drawn into the storytelling of like what it's like to be constantly kind of surveilled by DHS and child welfare agencies and what that feels like for kids, how scary it is for kids, how scary it is for moms and dads. David's an incredible lawyer. I can't wait to see where the litigation goes, but it was also really cool to think to hear from him how he designed the litigation. So I loved that session.
Wow.
And
Awesome.
then, I just want to say, like, this is a kind of a banner year for us bringing impacted voice into leadership in the American Bar Association's National Alliance for Parent Representation, in how we design and think about how we present materials to lawyers. So I again got to be around so many like personal heroes doing this work and people I'm learning from, like Angela Tucker, who is an adoptee, gave the closing plenary. She was really phenomenal. Victor Sims, another adoptee, also gave a talk about his book. And then, of course, April Lee from my office, Shonda Selivanoff from Washington State, Corey Best, Joyce McMillan, all of these impacted parents really stepping into leadership in the conference, really challenging us all to like think and do better. And so that was a really exciting piece of the work.
Wow. Now you led a session with Shanta Trivedi and April Lee on how the family policing system harms parents. Can you share the major themes of that discussion?
In 2019, Shanta Trivedi published a really seminal law review article called The Harm of Removal to Children, The Trauma of Removal to Children. And if your listeners are interested in learning more about what does it do to kids to experience separation through the child welfare system, that would be where I would say you should start, because it really is the most compelling article I've ever read about what it looks like in the lives of children, both in the short term and the long term, to separate them from their families. So that was a really powerful seminal law review article, and Shanta is a genius, a law professor out of University of Baltimore. She started thinking a little bit, and we've always kind of thought about this in our work as well. There's so much focus in the child welfare system on the child, which is rightly so, right? It is a system designed around children, but this is a system that has significant impacts on parents who are human beings, who experience their own trauma, grief, loss when the child welfare system intervenes in their lives. And so Shanta started thinking about that, like, why do we leave that out of the conversation so much? And even in our own advocacy as family defenders, right? And so Shanta wrote a new law review article about the harm of family separation to parents and the child welfare system to parents, that is pending publication, but I got a chance to read it. It's an incredible, powerful piece. And so we wanted to kind of sit with a group of family defenders and say, are we doing enough work to acknowledge, to raise awareness of the harm not only to children of child welfare intervention, but also to parents? One quote from Joyce McMillan that kind of sticks with me. I don't know if you've had Joyce, I think, on your show before.
Oh, yeah.
Joyce has this way of kind of summarizing things in a very pointed and kind of powerful way. But one thing that she says that has always stuck with me is that no system designed to protect children should mimic a system that tortures parents, right? And
Right.
and I think that's powerful. Like, if you want to protect children, start with supporting their moms and dads, right? That seems obvious, and yet that's not the system that we have in America. It's not how we've designed this system. And if you talk to parents, if you spend time in kinship with parents impacted by the system, they will tell you this feels like torture, right? Not
Right.
being with my child, being separated from my child, not knowing how my child's doing, not knowing when I'm going to get to be with my child again. And then, of course, the ultimate kind of torture we inflict on parents, termination of parental rights, making parents legal strangers to their own children. So, I mean, these are powerful harms that this system, this ostensibly caring system, is really inflicting on parents every day. And I think as a movement, we focus so much on children, rightly so. I mean, this is a system that perpetuates harm to children as well. But really, we wanted to challenge our audience and ourselves to think about how do we bring what this feels like to parents into some more of the conversations we're having around the child welfare system. And so it was a really robust conversation. And, we, Shanta and I especially, really wanted to own the way we as family defenders sometimes overlook the harm to parents and the system, because we're litigating cases around the best interest of the child,
Right.
and not really focusing enough on like, what is this doing to this mom or dad? And so we invited folks in the audience to think about their own family defense practice. What could they do to really elevate the voices of their own clients, right, in this work. So that was a really exciting and fun engagement with the audience.
Two things, just listening to you talk, two things. One, I really need to stick in here. We had Shanta Trivedi on our podcast back around the time of that first law review article. So if listeners want to go and check that out, then I would invite them to do so. And we'll put that link in the notes here. And then the other thing is, and I know you're aware, there are cases that talk about the reciprocal right of parents and their children to each other's companionship and so forth and so on. Like the courts have recognized, there's this interconnectedness. You can't. It's a right shared by both parents and children, right? And so, I'm just hearing that as you're talking about the harm to children that we focus on and we ignore the harm to parents, but they're interconnected.
That couldn't
I mean, if
be
it's the
more
same right and you
true.
destroy it, it
Right.
hurts us all.
And it's right. And as you say it, and as you know, all of us live within our own families, we know how we're doing impacts our children and how our children are doing impacts us. And like the idea that we're separating out these interests and pretending that we can serve children by harming their parents, it just doesn't make any sense. Like strong and healthy moms and dads raise strong and healthy kids. And so, you know, if we have a system that really wants to see strong and healthy kids, we should be focusing all our resources on how does this feel to parents? How are parents being supported through this process? And unfortunately, that's not the system we've designed. Even though instinctually, as a mom or a dad, we know this, right? We know that supporting moms and dads is great for kids.
So you now shifting gears, you also moderated the discussion on a bipartisan approach to reimagining the child welfare system, which ultimately is what Epic Broadcast is trying to bring about too. And that's why we have guests each week from both sides of the aisle, either side of the aisle. You know, one guest at a time, but it might be from the left this week and the right next week, and we're just bringing everybody together. Can you share with us a little bit about that, what that discussion covered?
That was really fun and something you and I have talked about a lot over the years. Thinking about how to bring folks from both sides of the aisle into like a really pro-family understanding of what the law and policy should look like. And one thing I'm sh sure of is that family is not a partisan issue. Family is an issue that we can all mobilize around. And so I wanted to work with some of our best advocates in the field. I'm talking about how they work and navigate kind of, you know, robust political differences in their own states and yet still accomplish powerful change for families. And so I had on my panel, I was the moderator of the panel, but Andrew Brown from Texas Public Policy Foundation, a pretty right-leaning organization that has accomplished massive legislative change in Texas, including getting a bill for Family Miranda that requires agencies to give tell families about their rights before they come into their homes, before they interview them. Shronda Sullivanoff, who is from Washington State, who's also done remarkable work changing their laws. She helped pass a major law called the Keeping Families Together Act that really looked at what is the standard to separate families in her state and really tightened that standard and made it harder to unnecessarily separate families. And then April Lee from my office, she's our director of client voice, a powerful, powerful, persuasive presence in every room I've ever been in with her. And so, and somebody who also, really is committed to building a big tent around valuing family. And so we spent some time talking about really two kind of buckets of things. One big thing we talked about is like, why reach across the aisle, right? Why should we be doing that? It's, you know, especially as polarized as we are in America right now, it can feel much more comfortable to just like hang out with your friends and family rather than kind of reaching across and saying, okay, we think about certain issues differently, but maybe we can come to consensus on the child welfare system and what needs to change. So, like, why do that? Why reach across the aisle? How do you do it? How do you re reach across the aisle? And I, you know, I just, I don't have my notes right in front of me, but I was taking notes as they were talking because, like, we just have a bunch of geniuses who are just not afraid to talk to anybody on our panel. And, you know, they were just kind of talking about some of their strategies about like recognizing it all starts with our shared humanity, right? And so Shronda is herself an impacted mother, didn't adopt her grandson, but is like the full-time caretaker guardian for her grandson after going through the child welfare system. And that led her to really want to do major legislative change in Washington state. And how she just kind of goes into legislative offices and doesn't start with, I'm a blue person, you're a red person, but like, we're people, we come from families, we value family, and really, she is one of the most persuasive advocates in the field. And I really think it's because of that, because she starts with this idea of our shared humanity. And so we spent some time thinking about how do you kind of bring folks together around a common purpose, even when they disagree politically on all sorts of other things. And then we went into nuts and bolts. And, we have some advocates who are just effective at getting things done, right? Like, how do you schedule a lobbying meeting? How do you draft language? How do you find your sponsor? How do you get it introduced? How do you build momentum in your state capital around this legislation? And so, like, all that nuts and bolts stuff was also really powerful. And just thinking about, how do you organize a campaign and how do you get it done? So it was a really exciting conversation. And I think family defenders, including myself, feel scared and nervous going into legislative spaces because, we're trained in the court of law, right? Like, that's what we do. Our job is to represent one client at a time. But the exposure we have in doing this work really helps us understand the policy issues at play in state statutory work that a lot of, so-called policy experts just don't have. They're just not proximate to the families that they're legislating about. And so to the extent that we can get in there, share that perspective, invite legislators to consider the real-world implications of whatever they're considering doing, I mean, I think family defenders, I think impacted parents are so powerful in those rooms. And so, like, really wanting to encourage our audience to jump in the pool. Like, I do think legislators need to hear from us. And so that was really exciting. We had a very packed room for that one.
No, absolutely. I echo what you're saying. And especially, I mean, any lawyers listening, and you, Kathleen, you say you're nervous going into those meetings. I've been in some of those meetings. I'm not a lawyer. But I've been in some of those meetings where then I introduce someone who is a lawyer and I see the change on the face of the person I'm meeting with. And they're like, oh, okay. Because their whole job is to make law and you guys are the ones practicing it and dealing with it and, wrestling with it by hand, as it were, day after day. So you know the law and you're using the law. It's your day-to-day bread and butter. And they recognize that. And so when you go in and you're a lawyer, there's a respect they have for you and your expertise. So absolutely, I would encourage any listeners, especially if you are a lawyer or but whatever skill you bring to it, to go in and talk with your lawmakers. And yeah, Kathleen, you should not be nervous going in and talking to lawmakers. they would, even the ones that disagree for whatever reason, and they have their political reasons and so forth, but they will respect you as a lawyer. It's been my experience anyway, that by and large, they'll respect you as a lawyer.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there is a respect for experience as a lawyer. I think the hardest thing in my experience about approaching legislators is like a sense that they've been educated and informed by like the media rather than, the kind of the real lived experience of parents and children who experience the system. And so like really knowing that you're walking into an audience that, either knows very little or what they do know might be kind of skewed and tilted, right, by what the media has done. And so how do you persuade that person that actually what you might think you know about the child welfare system is not what it looks like on the ground? And so bringing those kind of persuasive skills into, legislative halls seems really important. But not easy, so.
No, you're right.
Yeah.
No, you're right. Convincing somebody that what they know isn't actually true is, that's a challenge.
Yeah.
Well, so now our mutual friend Chris Gottlieb led a session about the harms of the Adoption and Safe Families Act, speaking of lobbying Congress and so forth, and what we can do to fix ASFA. Now, I understand you weren't able to go to that one because it was at the same time as one of yours.
Mm-hmm.
But I also know you wanted to talk about ASFA, and I do too, on this podcast. So let's talk about ASFA. What can we do? What's the
So
problem?
so there's a lot happening right now. And I was kind of bummed to miss the session because it not only was Chris Gottlieb, who is a professor and runs the Family Defense Clinic at NYU School of Law, it was Vivek Sankaran, who is a professor at University of Michigan, who's doing important litigation I would love to talk about. Christopher Church, who's a researcher and a mathematician, also a lawyer, who kind of brings his analytical skills to thinking about the data around termination of parental
Nice.
rights. And then Amy Mulzer, a family defense attorney of, and an appellate advocate who has written some really powerful law review articles, some of them getting into adoption and termination of parental rights. And Amy herself is an adoptive parent, and so brings a really unique lens into this work. So those four together on stage, and I had to miss it, which I was
Wow.
bummed about because they're just like, you know, all heroes and friends. But I guess I'll back up for a moment just to share a little bit about what is the Adoption Safe Families Act and why do we think it's a problem. The Adoption Safe Families Act was signed into law in 1997 by Bill Clinton, and the goal of the Adoption and Safe Families Act ostensibly was to end something called foster care drift, which is the idea that children are languishing in foster care for far too long, waiting to reunify with their moms and dads. And so as a result, we have to put a stop to that and move children swiftly to adoption by their foster parents. And so the Adoption and Safe Families Act created a timeline where presumptively, if a family can't reunify within 15 months, the agency must seek to terminate parental rights and place the child for adoption. That is a really harsh and punitive scheme on so many different levels. In the more than 25 years since ASVA was passed, we've learned so much. We've learned so much by listening to children who've experienced termination of parental rights about the deep trauma and loss they experience when they are permanently severed from their moms and dads, and also their whole family tree, right? So termination of parental rights is a really kind of brutal intervention in children's lives in that it takes away your mom and your dad forever, but it also takes away your legal right to your brothers and sisters, your aunts and uncles, your grandparents, your ancestry, right? And so we've definitely, as a field, started listening more to youth who were saying, this actually was really harmful to me. I wanted a lifelong connection to my own family. And ASVA said, if I couldn't have it within 15 months, I couldn't have it at all. And that's really draconian and harsh in the lives of children. It also causes extraordinary harm to parents, as I talked about in my other session. For parents, it's the ultimate loss. I mean, it's been called the civil death penalty. Interestingly, you know, in America, we have a criminal death penalty that there's been incredible momentum to around reform of that to say, like, if we're going to do this at all, it needs to be extremely rare and sparing. Like, this is a life, right? And yet, in the child welfare field, the civil death penalty is meted out 50,000 times a year, right? So, like, 50,000 times a year, we're forever severing a parent and a child and saying, you can't know each other as parent and child anymore. You have no rights to one another. That's an extraordinary harm in both of their lives and also causes intergenerational patterns of harm and separation that I see in my practice every day. So, you know, we've also learned a lot over the last 25 years about recovery, right? And what it looks like to recover. You know, parents who are, if they are separated because they're struggling with substance use disorder, to say, hey, you're going to be healed and solved in 15 months. We just inflicted upon you the worst trauma anyone can inflict upon a parent, which is taking away your child. And now we're going to say, get it together and fix all your other problems and reunify. I mean, that is not a realistic time frame for parents. It also ignores the real poverty implications of this. We have parents who are separated who, for reasons of poverty, and then are told, hey, stop being poor in 15 months, get a job, get adequate housing, you know? And that's not realistic either when you look at kind of intergenerational patterns of like underinvestment, isolation in family life. And to say like 15 months is some kind of magical number at which if the parent can't heal from their own trauma, heal from whatever else is going on in their lives, heal from their own poverty, they should never see their child again. I mean, that's really harsh and draconian, and also doesn't recognize what we know now about families. And so I've spent a lot of my advocacy bandwidth, which is not as broad as I would like. I do have a day job as a family defense attorney, but you know what, I do want to bring awareness of this to folks because I think it's not something we think about critically enough. There's been in the child welfare field a kind of mobilization and kind of growing consensus around the idea that family separation is harmful to kids, right? And then it has lifelong consequences that we've undervalued, underestimated, and that we should do far less of it, right? And I couldn't agree with that more. And so there's lots of activity right now in the child welfare system around how do we narrow the front door of the child welfare system? How do we make sure the only people who are being separated are those who are like really dangerous to their children, right? Which is really rare actually in child welfare separations. So there's so much mobilization and energy in the field and consensus in the field that we should be focusing on reducing unnecessary family separation at the front end, but really not a lot of attention to the fact that there's like this mass dismemberment of families happening at the back end. And very little policy attention being paid to the harm, the lifetime harm to children and parents of that apparatus being left in place. And it's completely in place right now, right? Like we haven't seen a significant slowing in our use of termination of parental rights in the lives of families, even as we learn more and more every day about just how harmful that is. So I've been really passionate about thinking about how do we focus our attention, turn our gaze toward the folks who are actually in this system and what they're experiencing, and thinking about what can we do to support them now. So that's something I've been focusing a lot on in my advocacy, trying to help folks understand the harm of a focus on termination above all else. Trying to help folks understand the concept of relational permanency. Relational permanency is this idea of like lifelong family connections, right? We all have a fundamental need to connect to our own families. It's part of our DNA. It's who we are as human beings, right? And when you take that away from a child, you're doing something pretty life-altering and often really inhumane. And so, like, how do we reorient our system to thinking about children's rights to lifelong relational permanency, that lifelong connection to their own families, and you know, and also how do we mobilize around the need to change this law? So
Right.
you know, this law is we've been stuck with it for 26 years now. What can we do to get it changed? And those are all the things I'm thinking about right now.
And I think you mentioned it was signed by Bill Clinton. I believe it was passed by Republican Congress and signed by Bill Clinton. So the fault, as it were, is bipartisan. And in Congress, I think there's some resistance that's also bipartisan. And I mean, here we are working to fix it. Also bipartisan. So it's not a clean, well, the Democrats are on this side and the Republicans are on that side. It's bipartisan on both sides, which makes it kind of hard to get the ball rolling, I think, in getting any real change out of Washington, D.C. But in talking, through our coalition relationships and also the folks I've had on the podcast through the years, I've been excited in seeing some of the alternatives, to TPR, to terminating parental rights. Judge Ernestine Gray talked about it at one point about, if there are other alternatives, then this isn't the least restrictive means. And of course, Vivek is leading that lawsuit right now in or the appeal in Michigan, where there are a couple of briefs. We've got a brief that we're adding to that, an amicus brief with Michael Ferris is writing. Chris Gottlieb, whom we're talking about, her session at the conference right now, and she's one of the authors on the other one, another brief on that same, and they're all talking about this least restrictive means. Are we really applying strict scrutiny to parental rights if we can terminate them so easily? And so I don't want to unpack all of that right now, but I am excited to see where we go with that. And I mean, that's the discussion we need to be having, isn't it? Is what can we do? If children need to be protected, which, as you said, is a very small minority, but when that happens, And if the parents can't get it together, there are alternatives to terminating their parental rights that allow us, like you said, to keep that lifelong relational connection, even if the parents can't be the ones responsible for their kids because of drug addiction or some other, failure or shortcoming. But they can still be a part of their lives. I mean, there are alternatives, right?
There are absolutely alternatives. And so, and what I want to say is, I do think we have to repeal ASFA, think about a new approach around the Adoption and Safe Families Act. But also, there are things we could do today to really significantly reorient our system around relational permanency for kids that wouldn't require any legislative change, right? So I guess I just wanted to say I do think sometimes I worry about the field us getting a little overwhelmed at like how hard it is to get anything done in Capitol Hill, because it is, right? But also we are making choices today to do what we do. We don't have to terminate 50,000 children's rights to their families a year, right? We could say, you know what? We're going to use this sparingly. This is really an incredible and traumatic intrusion into the rights of families. We're only going to do this when we absolutely have to do it. I don't know if you have been following another podcast that I enjoy quite a bit, The Proximity Process. My friend Matt Anderson hosts that. He actually was in leadership in North Carolina's largest foster care agency, and started recognizing the harm to parents of what the child welfare system was doing, and started to feel like he could no longer morally continue in his role as someone who prioritized foster care and adoption. So he left his job and started a podcast. It's called The Proximity Process. And he's been doing a series on ASFA and TPR, and like, why do we terminate so much? So just this week, he actually brought an agency leader from Boulder, Colorado on, who's really starting to think about, why do we do this so much? We don't actually have to do this, because we do have, first of all, we always have reunification on the table. And so there are lots of families who we're terminating on who could actually reunify if they had the supports. But also we have something called guardianship, right? And so that's, and every state calls it something different. In my state, it's called permanent legal custody. But that's the idea that a relative or a foster parent becomes the lifelong caregiver to this child. They're committing to this child until they're 18, but we're not terminating parental rights because we're recognizing that that child and that parent have an interest in lifelong family connection. We could almost always choose guardianship over termination of parental rights. To the extent that we're not, that's a practice choice, right? Like, we're deciding to do it that way. And so Molly Warren, this commissioner from Boulder, is saying, I want to make a different choice. We don't have, like, once, because everything in child welfare law is pegged to the best interest of the child, right? And once you understand that the best interest of the child is lifelong family connection, the way that you show up and do the work changes. And so I do think that's really exciting to think about, like, what could we do today in our practice to say, you know what, we are going to relentlessly protect a child's right to a lifelong relationship with her own family. We're going to see that as what's best when we are engaging with children and families. That would revolutionize practice today without the need for any legal change.
Awesome. As we wrap up, are there any final thoughts that you'd like to share with our audience in the last 1 or 2 minutes?
I would say the other thing I think about all the time is, how do we build a big tent around this work? Anybody who cares about children, about families, should care about the child welfare system and how it so often fails to get it right. We should really be thinking about how to work together. So I'm always thinking about, you know, if you work in education, if you work in medicine, if you work anywhere in the entertainment industry, like, kids or families are touched everywhere we go, and this should be a issue that we're all concerned about. Again, whether we're red or blue, Whatever our jobs are, we should all be interested in the welfare of children and getting it right for kids in America. And so I would, again, was so excited at the parent representation conference to see so many folks in so many different roles coming to the table. And so, like, please join us, like, learn more. I encourage listeners to listen to all the great family defenders who've been on your podcast. Follow other podcasts. There are some great books out there. I'll plug again, We Were Once a Family. Definitely just sit down and read that. You won't regret it. We all have to care about this together.
Awesome. And I want to say, I appreciate you being on the program again. I always enjoy talking with you. And I feel like we've left so much on the table today. We could have gone on for another hour.
Wait.
I appreciate everything you shared and your willingness to let's stop there and come back another time or something. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, and I'll always come back.
That's
So,
awesome. That's great.
yeah.
Now, this has been the Epic Broadcast, brought to you weekly on Tuesdays at parentalrightsfoundation.org/podcast or at iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you find the podcasts you listen to. Thank you for listening today. Kathleen, thank you again.
Thank you so much.